Good morning. You're listening to the Old Mall Variety Hour on KBOO.FM, Portland, Oregon. It's January 10, 2022. I'm Sharon Grant, your host for this program. On today's show, Bill Resnick asked Bill Smaldone, a teacher at Willamette University and writer of German history, to trace the rise and fall and rise again of Germany's oldest political party, the Social Democrats. After that, Omo movie critics Jan Hawken and Joe Clement discuss the film Don't Look Up. Lastly, Luisa Martinez interviews Antonia Morones on the recent presidential win in Chile by activist Gabriel Boric. We begin with Bill Resnick and Bill Smaldone. This history is important because in September last year, surprising all the experts and prognosticators, it rose again to win the German election by promising to return to its roots, to speak, and when in power, to legislate in the interests of the working class. Smaldone co-founded Radio KMUZ in Salem, an independent station like KBOO. Among his books are Confronting Hitler, German Social Democrats in Defense of the Weimar Republic, and European Socialism.
Hi, Bill Smaldone. Welcome again to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. I'm glad to be back.
Bill Smaldone teaches history at Willamette University, his specialty, Germany in the 20th century. He writes a good deal. Among his books are Confronting Hitler, German Social Democrats in Defense of the Weimar Republic, and European Socialism. He served 4 years as a radical on the Salem City Council, and he co-founded KMUZ Radio, a KBOO-like station in Salem, Oregon. Today we'll be discussing the Social Democratic Party in Germany. For many years after World War II, the largest political party in Germany led the coalition that ran the government. For the last decade, it's been slowly losing votes and appeared to be dying. But it revived in the German election last September and formed now the governing coalition. In that Germany is dominant in European policymaking, it's very important in setting international policy and programming as to dealing with the many crises of our age, inequality, climate change, continued Cold War efforts by the United States. We'll be discussing the program of the Social Democratic Party and what they could and might do in the coalition they formed. So, Bill Smaldone, give us a thumbnail sketch of development of the party from its origins in 1863.
Well, it's hard to do in just a few minutes, but to keep it brief, I would say that the Social Democratic Party got its start in tandem with Germany's rapid industrialization at the end of the 19th century. And as the country urbanized and as the waged workforce grew ever larger in the cities, German socialists, who had been active in the middle of the 19th century but had a rather small constituency, were very successful at organizing workers. They basically worked in two spheres. On the one hand, they built a political party that was rooted in all major cities of the country and lots of small towns. It didn't have much roots in the countryside, where the peasantry was still very large, but it did very well in the cities. And simultaneously, Social Democrats created a very large trade union movement. And together, the Social Democratic Party and the trade unions did everything they could in the pre-World War I period, a period in which Germany was a pseudo-autocratic state. They did everything they could to build a more democratic system, to win democratic rights for workers, many of which they were denied. They also worked to expand all sorts of social reforms that would strengthen workers' hands and improve life for workers. The Social Democrats put forward a vision of a future in which workers would hold power, not only in the workplace, but also in the state. And they argued that the way forward was to fight within the system and to win improved political rights and social rights, and to do so as long as the system allowed it to make gains. They argued that if the system tried to repress the workers' movement, then it was the duty of the workers to make a revolution. And this led in the pre-World War I period to certain disputes within the party about how to manage their strategy. On the one hand, you had a group that argued mainly for reformist goals and that didn't like to use revolutionary language to win support. They believed that the party was primarily a reform party, working for socialism, but via reforms. Then you had a centrist group led by people like Karl Kautsky, who argued that the party was a revolutionary party. It was preparing workers for revolution, and that the revolution could occur in one of two ways, via gradual reform or via revolution, if necessary. And then you had a third group, a smaller group, led by people like Rosa Luxemburg, who argued that it was the duty of the party to fight for reforms, but also to use the streets more effectively to build a revolutionary consciousness among the workers and prepare them for revolutionary action. And these three groups within the party vied for influence. The most important one was that middle group led by Kautsky, which had by far the largest amount of support, and it dominated the party until 1914. The great moment of truth for social democracy occurred in 1914 when this international party, a party that advocated for international workers' revolution, basically abandoned that principle and rallied around the national flag when war broke out. And that caused those internal divisions that I just described ultimately to lead to a split in the party. And during the war, you had a division between those who opposed the war and those who supported the war and therefore supported the imperial state. The upshot of it all was that in 1917, the opposition to the war group was expelled, and in the spring of 1917, organized a second Social Democratic Party in Germany, which opposed the war. That group grew increasingly large as the war unfolded, and it was also very variegated in its membership, and it had a number of radicals, including people like Rosa Luxemburg, who advocated after 1917 for a more radical Bolshevik-style revolution. And in 1918, when the German people overthrew the imperial state, you then had a fundamental division within social democracy between those who believed that the new state, which was a parliamentary state, provided a framework to move towards socialism, and those who believed that it was simply a capitalist republic that needed to be overthrown. That group wished to set up a republic based on workers' councils, following the model in Russia. And so you had a very deep split within the workers' movement after the revolution of 1918. The result of that split was that for the entire period of the Weimar Republic's existence from 1919 until 1933, the labor movement was essentially divided between a social democratic socialist movement and a communist party, which also opposed the republic. So the republic had opposition in the end from the right, that is from anti-republicans, and also from the far left, the communists. Both groups wished to overthrow it. And the social democrats, who still saw socialism as their goal, but believed that it could be achieved within the framework of a parliamentary republic, the social democrats were the main prop, the main supporters of the Weimar system. All of them were destroyed by the Nazi seizure of power in 1933. All of them, their leadership was either driven underground, driven into exile, or arrested and put in camps. And the socialist movement in Germany was effectively dead for the period of the Third Reich until 1945. In 1945, the socialist movement re-emerged in Germany. Initially, there were hopes that it would emerge as a unified, radical, Marxist movement that would work to create a socialist republic. That hope was dashed in the context of the Cold War. What you had then was the emergence of a West German polity in which a revived Social Democratic Party, a parliament-oriented socialist movement, was reestablished. And in Eastern Germany, which was initially under Soviet occupation, you had the emergence of a communist regime dominated by a revived communist party. Now, what's interesting for us here is to note that in the initial years after 1945, in the West, the Social Democratic Party continued to be a party that advocated a kind of Marxian socialism and that claimed to be a party of the workers and claimed to wish to establish a system based on parliamentary political forms, but one that would also include a largely planned economy. And in the elections in West Germany, beginning in 1949 and all the way through the 1960s, the early 1960s, the Social Democrats were unable to win more than 30% of the vote. And in that situation, it basically left the field to a right-of-center Christian democratic movement that also advocated for some government intervention, but largely for a market economy. And most Germans were more comfortable, especially in the Cold War context, voting for the Christian Democrats than they were for the socialists, who were often lumped in with the communists, who in the West were persecuted and eventually banned in 1956. So you have a situation in which the Social Democrats found themselves very frustrated. And in 1959, after much internal debate, they jettisoned the Marxist elements of their party program, the Marxist ideology, the focus on class struggle, and advocated a form of socialism that would be based more on, say, Christian ethics than on the ideal of class struggle. And this sort of opened the party to a broader constituency, one that made it easier for middle-class people and people who had earlier feared the party's atheism and so on. It opened the door to a larger variety of people. And in the 1960s, that enabled the Social Democrats in one election after the other to broaden their voting base, especially when they discovered a charismatic political figure by the name of Willy Brandt, who was sort of Kennedy-esque, and by 1966 became the standard bearer for the Social Democrats. And in 1969, he led them ultimately to an electoral victory in which, for the first time, they were the largest party electorally in the parliamentary elections. So for the first two decades of the post-war period, the Social Democrats were in a state of transition, and they don't achieve power until 1969 in coalition with the Free Democrats. They were still unable to rule alone. They did not have an absolute majority. Meanwhile, in the East, the communists dominated the state there and built up a Soviet-style planned economy with a full-blown welfare state. And there was a hefty competition between the Social Democrats in the West and the communists in the East. And the Social Democrats were quite aware that they needed, in effect, to make sure that they offered workers enough benefits, enough gains, so that they could maintain the allegiance of their working class constituency while also broadening their base into other groups. So after 1969, when the Social Democrats came to power, they were able to build on a nascent welfare state that had been created by the Christian Democrats in the 1950s and early 60s and expand it substantially. In 1969, Willy Brandt's slogan to bring the Social Democrats to power was "Dare More Democracy," and that brought in all kinds of people like students and other social groups that the Social Democrats wanted to win. But it also kept affiliated with the SPD and broadened their support among workers who were interested in expanding workers' power in the workplace, right, and giving workers more collective bargaining rights. In fact, giving workers the right to co-determination in large industries where they would be able to sit at the table with capital as equals and work out a better deal for themselves. So that was a really important moment in post-war German history. And for the next 12 years after 1969, the Social Democrats ran the government and expanded the welfare state, brought about co-determination in wide swaths of German industry. All German firms, for example, have works councils in them, which are elected by the workers, and this is whether the shops are unionized or not. This is a really important reform that gives workers a lot more say over their working lives than American workers could ever imagine. Right? And these were big achievements that the Social Democrats brought about in the 60s and 70s.
Hi, folks. This is KLU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. You just heard Bill Smaldone, a teacher at Willamette University and writer of German history. He traced the rise and fall and rise again in the first 100 years of Germany's oldest political party, the Social Democrats. We'll now go back to Bill to conclude the history of the party. This history is important because in September of 2021, last year, surprising all the experts and prognosticators, it rose again to win the German election by promising to return to its roots, to speak and, when in power, legislate in the interests of the working class.
After 1982, the Social Democrats lost power when the Christian Democrats, they lost power when the Free Democrats, their coalition partners for over 12 years, abandoned ship and decided instead, after the elections of 1982, to form a coalition with the Christian Democrats. And the reason why they did that was because there was a swing within the Free Democratic Party, which is basically a party of free traders. That party had moved a bit to the left in the 1960s, but by the 1980s, the free market group had again seized control, and they were more comfortable working with the Christian Democrats, and they formed an alliance with them in 1982, and they stayed with the Christian Democrats then for the next 16 years. And during all that time, the Social Democrats were out of power and were trying to figure out how to get back in. And a lot happened in that 16-year period. For example, the East Bloc collapsed. And under the leadership of Helmut Kohl, the Christian Democratic German leader, the two Germanys were reunited. And they were reunited also in a context of the formation of the European Union. And all of that was carried out not on the basis of the post-war economic consensus that was largely Keynesian in terms of its framework. On the contrary, they were all those things happened on the basis of the ascendant neoliberal economic model that permeated German government politics in the 1980s and 90s, but also EU politics. And the Social Democrats in that period were strongly influenced by neoliberal arguments. And so the party moved rightward. A major moment came in the election of 1998 when the Social Democrats took power once again, this time in alliance with the Rising Green movement. And for a moment, it appeared that under Gerhard Schröder's leadership, there was going to be a turn against neoliberalism and a turn more in a pro-Keynesian direction. But Schröder abandoned that very quickly and ultimately adopted a kind of this notion of the third way between the neoliberals, he argued, and the old Keynesians. And what that really amounted to for the Social Democrats was a shift to the right and a movement toward market-oriented policies. And this was a disaster for them because by bringing about a dismantling of elements of the welfare state, the Social Democrats, after 2004, abandoned a very large part of their constituency, the workers. And so they cast aside the working class and they tried to expand their constituency into the middle classes that had earlier voted for the Christian Democrats. And as a result, the Social Democrats were no longer conceived by many German people as the party of justice. They were now considered just one more free market party that really didn't care about its workers, that didn't care about Germany's workers. And the workers felt abandoned and cast about for a new home. And some of them moved then to the left and joined the Left Party, which advocated a much more traditionally social democratic program. And some of them began to move to the right and wound up in the camp, not just of the Christian Democrats, but also of the newly rising nationalist Alternative for Germany, which, beginning in the second decade of the 21st century, began to win support in Germany, especially as people grew upset with the immigration politics within the EU.
That after was the right-wing party.
That was the right-wing, right. So after 2004, the Social Democrats, in some ways, forgot who they were. They abandoned their traditions, and they abandoned their previously loyal major working class constituency. And they did that in a quest to expand their middle class support. And as a result, they wound up fighting with the Christian Democrats much more tenaciously over the middle. And the Christian Democrats were able to win most of the time in that competition. So after 2004, the Social Democrats were not able to win German elections on their own. Interestingly, for much of the period between 2004 and 2020, they ruled with the Christian Democrats as a junior partner in what were called great coalition governments. And this occurred because in the German parliamentary system, in order to form a government, you have to have the support of the majority of the delegates to the parliament. And these are organized by party fractions. And so the German system often requires, if nobody has an absolute majority, it requires negotiation among the parties to form new governments. And for much of the last 15 years or so, the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats ruled together, but they ruled under the domination of Christian Democratic prime ministers, right, such as Angela Merkel, who has been in power for 16 years, up until 2020. So that, one might also say, worked against the Social Democrats, because even when they attempted to recover some of their lost identity and to promote traditional Social Democratic Party politics, they really were unable to get out from under the shadow of the Christian Democrats. They lost their profile. And this hurt them in one election after the other. And so in 2015, they only scored 15% of the vote, which was down from 40% 10 years before. That's pretty catastrophic. And people began to think about the end of social democracy. People thought that given the rise of the Greens and the rise of the left party, and then the rise of the Alternative for Germany on the right, that social democracy might be about to essentially dissolve. That's why the victory in 2020 by Olaf Scholz is so important, because Olaf Scholz was able to lead the Social Democrats back to power. The Social Democrats won 26% of the vote, making them the largest faction in the Bundestag, in the parliament, and therefore giving them the right to take the lead in negotiating a coalition government. And they negotiated a coalition with the Greens, who got something like 14% of the vote, and then with the Free Democrats, who are right-of-center liberal party, but they're the ones who often shift back and forth in the center, giving their alliance first to the Christian Democrats and then occasionally to the SPD. And there has been a shift within the FDP to move in a leftward direction and join this coalition. I should also say that in 2021, one of the reasons why it was possible to form a coalition of these rather different parties. Social Democrats and Greens have a lot in common, but the FDP, the Free Democrats, are really quite different. And one of the reasons why all three parties came together was because there was a fear that if nobody formed a majority coalition, it would only fuel the strength of the right. Okay, and it's important for the stability of the state to form a stable government and to make policy, especially given the current crisis, the COVID crisis and the climate crisis. So that provides some context to the election of 2020 and the new government in 2021.
Hi, folks. You just heard Bill Smaldone on the history of Germany's Social Democratic Party that won the 2021 German election by returning to its roots and championing the interests of Germany's working class. Also promising to deal with the great crises of our time, the viral pandemics, climate change, growing inequality and precarity, and the threat of right-wing authoritarianism. Next week, Bill Smaldone and I will explore how the Social Democrats plan to succeed in this, especially to model the way to stop the process of slow but speeding up global roasting. Bill Smaldone teaches history at Willamette University with a specialty on Germany in the 20th century. Bill co-founded Radio KMUZ in Salem, a cable-like station. His books are Confronting Hitler, German Social Democrats in Defense of the Weimar Republic, and another book, European Socialism.
Call my baby, little girl, feel the calm.
Muddy Waters, Cold Water Blues. Before, we heard from Bill Resnick speaking to Bill Smaldone. You're listening to the OMO Variety Hour on KBOO.FM Portland. You will find previous episodes of the OMO Variety Hour at KBOO.FM. This episode will be available there later today. And next up, Movie Mole's Joe Clement and Jan Hawken discuss the film Don't Look Up, a satirical film directed by Adam McKay and featuring a star-studded cast. Enlisting many of the tropes of Hollywood disaster films, Don't Look Up follows a professor of astronomy and his graduate student as they try to mobilize the government to respond to their alarming finding that a comet is hurling towards Earth and on a path to destroy all life on the planet. The comet serves as a metaphor for the climate emergency, and the film satirizes media, corporate, and governmental complicity in downplaying the severity of the emergency. Jan and Joe discuss conflicting critical reviews of the film and offer their own takes on how Don't Look Up works as part of a larger genre of disaster films, as well as what it intends to say about disaster capitalism.
Don't Look Up, directed by Adam McKay, is about two astronomers discovering that a Mount Everest-sized comet is due in 6 months' time to hit planet Earth and wipe out all human life. The scientists present their alarming findings to the White House and the press, only to find that political leaders and the media can't or won't grasp the urgency of the situation. The film has been widely praised and reviled as a cautionary tale about the climate emergency and the forces that stand in the way of responding to the scale of the crisis. So Joe, Don't Look Up, like many Hollywood disaster films, starts with government officials ignoring the warnings of scientists. In this case, an astronomy professor and the woman graduate student who discovers the comet and its fateful trajectory. So let's start with how the film operates as a cautionary tale about climate change and media and government failures to heed the urgent warnings of scientists. What's your take on how the film works on that critical level?
Well, like a lot of films that have had this exact same plot structure, which is that it's discovered, it's brought to the attention of the political elite, but it seems like such a rare, if not non-existent kind of thing, that it's not taken seriously until they're able to make the data speak for itself. And in this film, they do something very similar. They have a campaign where they break out and they create public pressure to listen to the scientists. And eventually the political establishment embarks on what seems like a plan, the kind of standard go blow it up plan. What ends up happening is that plan is derailed. It is derailed by the capitalist class represented by this billionaire figure, Peter Isherwell, played by Mark Rylance, very smarmy, but kind of soft-spoken old white guy. And he wants to mine the comet and exploit it for the trillions of dollars worth of rare earth metals and hundreds of trillions of dollars of other just more standard materials. And they are able to sway the government to abandon its straightforward mission to just solve the problem. And that is where the second take, shifting from disaster films to disaster capitalism, really shines in this film. It's about the absurdity of the inaction, but it's trying to draw a line between what could be happening and what is happening that is spelling out in a climate context a lot of what we see when it comes to the kinds of corporate strategies for dealing with climate change, from carbon markets to carbon capture to geoengineering and all this, that aren't about stopping the source of climate change, but constantly trying to keep up with its consequences. And I think people are resonating with the film around that particular like large story arc, because it's about trying to shake awake the real world as to what's going on before we get to the point where the comet ends up hitting the Earth and intervene in it, stop it, say no to it.
I think part of what makes the film work on an emotional level is the character of the young woman graduate student, astronomy graduate student, played by Jennifer Lawrence. And she is trying to present a rational argument about the scientific basis of her findings and the nature of the threat, catastrophic threat that the government needs to respond to. But she's seen as kind of a downer by others, not a very effective media spokesperson, as a hysteric by conservatives. And I think a lot of her persona, her character in this film, channels feelings and emotions in the climate movement itself, feeling outrage, alarm, and despair over the failure of a meaningful government response to the crisis itself. Although then that leads me to follow the trajectory of her character over the course of the film, something we might also talk about. How does the film make use of the comet as a metaphor for climate crisis? And what is the trajectory, not only of the comet, but of the responses to those who are most alarmed?
Yeah, the comet is bringing the crisis in an inexorable way to humanity. And a lot of critics, and even McKay, have pointed to the social response to these existential crises is really kind of what is the problem in the film. The comet is just what it is, and it's moving forward, and it's going to complete its trajectory unless we do something to change that. With climate change, there is a much more reflexive thing going on where what we do will be what changes it, but that's not just one thing. We're not just going to go out and blow up one thing. And how do we collectively accomplish that one task? It's it's often remarked that climate change is this complex thing, and it has all of these different facets of mitigation and response. And the film scares some folks because it seems to suggest that we are collectively incapable of mounting that response, and is just in that way kind of pessimistic. But I don't know whether I agree with that, because I think the film is trying to deal with that whole dynamic itself in the way that it's split between the first part of the film where they get a plan ready to send out the space shuttles outfitted with nuclear bombs and just blow it up. And the derailing of that plan is, you know, what we're stuck with for the rest of the film. But this isn't the limit to what we can do. It's a comment on this line of action and thought that the capitalists introduce into the idea of responding to the crisis. And that really the film portrays a lot of lucidness from ordinary people when the question of, like, there is this terrible thing coming, like, people of several of the street scenes, like, will stop and say, wait, what are you talking about? It's a crisis of the political culture of the elites and of the larger, you know, upper part of society that works with them, which is in large part the media.
I would like to get back to the question of the comet as a metaphor for climate change. And I think you're right that by approaching climate change through a metaphor, it allows the audience to get a hold of something. It concretizes what's more elusive and provides a way to, well, talk about something while not talking about it, kind of opening up space for exploring themes that might be more difficult if it were directed to the audience as this is a film about climate change. But I also do feel that it's a misplaced metaphor in many ways, not only in the sense of, you know, does it correspond to the actual threat of climate change? And here McKay draws and has a company called Hyperobjects Industry, his media company, that takes up the ideas of Timothy Morton, who's a philosopher who coined the term hyperobjects and has written about global warming, saying that the human mind has not evolved to grasp the scope of the climate problem. And so you can see how the work of Timothy Morton and this concept of hyperobject would lead to a kind of hyper-concretized way of approaching the crisis. And of course, there are differences in terms of the comet is an abrupt event and climate change is more gradual. But more than that, the comet is a natural disaster and it hits randomly. And with the climate crisis, it's not a random natural event. And the oil and gas industries have tried to portray it as a kind of a force of nature and an inevitable product of the modern world and the industrial age. And in that sense, I think it's a problematic metaphor and obscures, though one might say it may open space in another way to talk about what's really driving the death of much of life on the planet. But the fact that the climate crisis is driven by a relatively small group of corporate interests that have downplayed the threat and fostered denial or minimization of the climate crisis is itself eclipsed by the metaphor. And as a natural disaster, it does, I think, cultivate a certain potential cynicism and pessimism about the prospects for a livable future.
I can see what you mean by how the singularity of the comet and the way that it comes from just its own space then obscures how there is a geography of climate change. It is unequal. It, you know,
in its impacts, right?
In its impacts, in its sources. You know, Jason Hickel's book that I talked about last year, Less is More, How Degrowth Will Save the World, points at how the global north, meaning Europe and the United States, but also Japan and Australia, bear the lion's share of climate change causing activity. Even when it's sourced from the global south, it's happening in the global south because of the imperial dynamics of the global north. And that is not clear in this movie. There's some moments where, you know, they're talking about where the comet's going to land. At first, before the comet was going to be blown up, it was expected to land off of the shore of South America. And when they end up blowing up the comet in order to try and harvest the materials from it, it ends up fanning out the comet like a shotgun across the globe. And that is also kind of obscuring how it's still falling on the global south. It's not now everybody's problem because we're all in the same boat. It's a big boat. And, you know, there's many different parts of it. And the ruling classes have created these seals, these emergency seals called nation states between the different regions of the globe. And they want to police them. It's why the wall is such a big deal to the right-wing movement in this country. It is about the possible response to the eco crises that are unconsciously, you know, recognized, but then consciously denied.
The film has been praised by many scientists, and that's kind of an interesting aspect of the film. And, you know, you can't walk a block in my neighborhood without seeing a Believe Science sign along with Black Lives Matter. Clearly, the way in which science has been held hostage by the right and the anti-science dominates the right wing. I also think science is a more complicated world than simply Believe Science. So if I had to pick a side, I would pick Believe Science. But I think it's interesting that the film enlists astronomers to establish its scientific credentials, which I think is fine. But there are many claims, including the work of Timothy Morton and his cognitive psychology that seems to inform McKay to some extent, is, I think, wrong in many ways. And that may be a discussion for another day, but how much humans have evolved in a way that limits their ability to grasp the climate crisis, which is McKay's point, and I think informed the choice of the comet as a metaphor. In some ways, the cynicism of the film is not in poking fun at the public. I agree, you're right, that most of the parody is of people in power in the media. But I do think the comic skills and the writing skills that are evident in this film could be turned to something closer to the actual crisis we face, and that humans are able to grasp the seriousness, even as diffuse as it is and as complex as it is, in sizable numbers. There's a majority of people in this country and around the world that either express alarm or extreme concern about the climate crisis itself and understand many of the forces driving it.
Yeah. We heard last week on Sojourner Truth on KBOO some folks who had written a publication called Hoodwinked in the Hot House, which stresses indigenous traditional knowledge and social practice perspective in climate mitigation. And what I find interesting in Hoodwinked in the Hot House is they emphasize public interest science. And something the film is offering a glimpse on is this difference between public interest and corporate interest science, that the scientists come from this state college. They are very kind of podunk. They're from Michigan, for crying out loud. And they've got these podunky accents. And whenever they are in communication about the comet, there is often a reference made to, like, oh, they're only from a state school, or we need to get these corporate or Ivy League scientists to give us the results or say what we want. And that there's a tradition of just demonizing science on the left, but there's also been a tradition of, like, reclaiming science and of recognizing that it is actually power that belongs to the public and that is necessary for the public to respond to these huge issues, that we need traditional knowledge, we need scientific knowledge that is gained and pursued for the public interest.
Yeah, and there's also a question of who are the experts. And I think to the extent that this championed the hero in this was largely, and the less corrupted one, was the young woman astronomy graduate student from Michigan State University. She's kind of closer to everyday people. She's a woman. And actually, astronomy has been a very male-dominated field. So she represented kind of the emerging voices of women in male-dominated areas of science. But I think there's always this question, who are the experts? Who are the people who can most effectively document the trajectory of the problem of the climate crisis? And in my own work, I've been interested in frontline communities as experts in documenting the effects of climate emergency for some time. And so it's not only university-based scientists, whether state schools or elite schools, that speak to these effects. And I think the film does kind of open up that question, though, in interesting ways. Who are the legitimate scientists that correctly diagnose the problems we face. So it's certainly a film worth watching for the discussions it's generated. And if it revives some of the libido of the climate justice movement, hooray, so be it. I'm all for that. But I think I'm not as enthused as you are about the film, or more cautious about it. But it's certainly worth seeing.
This has been Joe Clement and Jan Hocken. We've been talking today about the dark comedy, Don't Look Up. If you tune into the KBOO website, kboo.fm/oldmole, in a day or two, you can hear a bit more conversation about this popular movie.
That music was Childish Gambino's Feels Like Summer. You're listening to the Oldmole Variety Hour on KBOO.FM Portland. And that was the Movie Moles, Jan Hocken and Joe Clement, discussing the film Don't Look Up. In our last piece today, Luisa Martinez interviews Antonia Mardones Marshall on the recent presidential win in Chile by leftist and former student activist Gabrielle Boric.
This is Luisa Martinez. Today, I'll be interviewing Antonia Mardones Marshall on the recent presidential win in Chile by leftist and former student activist Gabriel Boric. Mardones is a member of the Central Committee of the Convergencia Social Party and was the international campaign coordinator for the presidential candidacy of Gabriel Boric. His election is seen as the result of a massive popular movement towards upending decades of neoliberalism imposed by the 73 US-backed coup, which installed Augusto Pinochet. Hi, Antonia. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Luisa. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So for some background, for those listeners who don't know very much about Chile and what's happening recently, can you explain what gave rise to the popular movement that ultimately supported Boric's presidential win?
Yes, of course. So I think this is basically the result of the accumulation of many struggles in the past two decades. Of course, the student movement from where Boric comes from was a very important component, first with the high school student protest that started in 2006, but also then with the 2011 movement where university students were protagonists and where they put, like, for the first time in the agenda, the demand for a free, quality, universal education in the country. Chile is a country very neoliberal and with all, like, education, health, pensions, very privatized. So we have the student movement happening on the other movements growing in the past years, especially in regions that have been denominated in Chile as zonas de sacrificio, sacrifice zones, where industries have polluted entire areas and have deteriorated, like, the health of all the communities living there. We had a very important movement also against the privatized pension system that has been growing in the past decade under a movement called No Más AFP, that is against this system that was also created during the dictatorship of Pinochet. And that resulted in that the average retiree in Chile receives what we call pensions of misery, because they're under the line of poverty and they're not enough to cover, like, basic needs. And I would say that then another component very relevant was the feminist movement. The feminist movement has been a protagonist in this process. It was especially strong in 2017, 2018 forward. And in fact, the analysis of the data from the election shows that it was all mostly young women who were the ones that most very important component of the female vote in these elections. So I think that all of these demands were consolidated in some way in Boric's presidential program. He promised to be the first, like, feminist and environmentalist government. And at the same time, his program highly prioritized issues that are, like, in the forefront of these demands, as the democratization and universal access of dignified health, education, pensions. So yeah, I think he was able to kind of personify, like, bringing together all these movements that were happening for a while, that were coming from the last two decades, at least.
OK, Okay, and so you've mentioned feminists and students. Who else comprised the coalition that supported his presidential campaign? And then what role do these, I mean, it was a coalition of parties, of different interests, movements. Could you talk about those?
Yeah, of course. So since the student movement in 2011, we have a generation like several of the leaders of that movement were able to penetrate representatives in 2013. And from there, like different social movements began to converge to create a leftist coalition that is called in Chile El Frente Amplio, that translates the broad front, that created kind of like a new left in the country. The Frente Amplio is like a very new coalition. It has 5 years, but it like very rapidly had a presidential candidate for the 2017 elections that did very good, didn't pass to the ballotage, but almost did. And it comprised different parties and social movements, okay? From this process, some of the movements began to come together and to converge in political parties, knowing that in Chile, it's very difficult to compete if you don't have a legal instrument, like a legalized party. So we have this broad front on one side. And then after the uprising of 2019, the broad front was able to create an alliance with the more historical left, that is also by other social movements and parties. And we created like a coalition that is called Apruebo Dignidad, Approve Dignity, broadly, roughly translated. And this coalition was very successful actually for the elections of people for the Constitutional Assembly in Chile and for the election of representatives. So it has been growing. And we had a primary between a communist candidate and Gabriel Boric, which Boric won that primary election. And after that, we have had other parties like come to support Boric, especially from like the social democrats, center left, especially the Socialist Party. After the first round where their candidate lost, they came together also to support Boric. So we have like a broad support from social movements, grassroots, the left, the traditional parties, and also the center left parties. Yeah.
Okay. And then just to give a little bit more background, could you talk about the constitutional convention election and then the upcoming national plebiscite and the historical significance of those two things?
Yeah, definitely. So, well, this all resulted from a very particular moment in Chile's history that was that the symbolic date is October 18 of 2019, and we call it like the Estallido Social. It's like the Chilean uprising that happened because of this uprise of the metro fare of the public transportation, but it was kind of like the tip of the iceberg of a growing feeling of discontent and injustice in the country. Chile is a country that has an impressive amount of growth since the end of the dictatorship in the last three decades. But people have an increasing also feeling of living very precarious lives with huge debts and increasing notion of how these benefits of the growth of the country are benefiting just a minority. So it's a very rich country in the Latin American context, but very, very unequal. So the coming to the what we have now as a constitutional assembly was a very unique moment. And it's very relevant that Gabriel Boric was one of the main actors who participated in an agreement between the political class to canalize all this discontent into an institutional process. First for a plebiscite that was about a year ago, in which the Chilean people could vote if they wanted or not a new constitution, and if they wanted it written by people from Congress or by people elected democratically only to write the constitution. And by a huge majority, 80% of the population voted for a new constitution and for it to be written by democratically elected people. So we have for the first time a constitution in the country for the first time written in this way by democratically elected people, but also with gender parity. This is a very special, I think it's unique in the world that like it's equal amount of women and men that are writing the constitution, and also with the inclusion of reserved seats for indigenous people that are participating in this process. And I think a lot of the presidential election of the past December was seen in some way as a continuity of the plebiscite, in the sense that Boric and our coalition have been constant defenders of the process, of the constitutional process, while his opponent, José Antonio Kast, was the most visible face against the new constitution and has been a defender of the 1980 constitution that was written during the dictatorship.
Speaking of Kast, for those of you who don't know, he was the aborted presidential opponent in the election and was labeled by many as a fascist. In fact, it was revealed during his campaign that his father was, in fact, a bona fide member of the German Nazi Party, despite Kast denying these allegations for a long time. He's made comments such as, if Pinochet were alive, he would vote for me. He said he would dissolve the women's ministry that was formed for the specific purpose of addressing violence and gender inequalities. He's anti-abortion. I mean, I could go on in terms of the radical right-wing nature of Kast, but I wanted to ask, you've had considerable exposure to US culture. You've lived here and studied here. And so I always want to be very careful not to be US-centric when, you know, we write pieces on, we develop pieces on foreign politics. But do you believe that it's fair to compare it Kast with former US President Trump? And if so, in what ways?
Kast for sure, he and his family have been very linked to the Chilean dictatorship. He has a brother that worked for the Pinochet regime. And Kast was an advocate in the 1989 plebiscite to continuing with Pinochet in power. So it's like, yeah, in fact, he has been very linked and he has been a defender of that very bloody dictatorship. And I think he has some similarities with Trump, and not only with Trump, but also with Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. I think in that sense, he represents this alt-right that has been growing in the past, I would say 5 years, but maybe a little bit more. It has been growing a lot in Latin America, in the US, and also in Europe, gaining a lot of visibility. And this alt-right is different from the conservative right that we were used to, right? I would say that Kast, similarly than Trump, presented himself in many ways as a radical, like as an anti-status quo person, as an outsider of politics that came here to do things differently. And in that way, he was able to appeal some even young people vote because he was seen like not the same. Isn't an outsider. He was a representative in Congress for the UDI, that is like the most right-wing conservative party, but a traditional party for several terms. So he was part of that like political class before he created his own party in the, I don't know, 4 years ago or something like that. He went out of the UDI, that was a very conservative right-wing party, to create an even more conservative and more right-wing party that has like much more visible, things like agendas around like anti-abortion, anti-gay, anti-immigrants, that has like many similarities when you see Bolsonaro or Trump supporters in the US.
But he lost. So switching gears, can you give some background to the Convergencia Social Party and what you hope to achieve as a coalition for the future of Chile?
Yes, Convergencia Social, that is the party of our elected president. We're very proud to say so. It's a very young party. We created the party around 3 years ago in 2019. And it was created like from the convergence of these different social movements I was talking to you about before. I come from one of those that is called the Movimiento Autonomista, but there were several different movements. It's four movements that came together to create like this political instrument that could help us dispute elections and dispute actual power. Despite this, like it's a very young party, it has grown very quickly. Today, we have seven people writing the new constitution. And in the recent elections, we got eight elected representatives. Before that, we had four representatives in Congress. Now we duplicated them to eight. So we will begin the next term with the presidential election much more empowered. And it's because it is also the party of the elected president, we find like many, many people wanting to join and wanting to be part of this project because there's a lot of expectation and there's a lot of hope in this party and our coalition, the Frente Amplio and Apruebo Dignidad for the future government. And I would say that for the term that comes, it's a difficult question because we won the elections, the presidential elections for quite a bit. So there is a lot of legitimacy over the government. But at the same time, we had Congress elections and the Congress is very divided today. So half of the Congress is in the hands of the right wing. So we know that there are many of the reforms that we want to do that are going to be very fast Congress. So we have to see how to prioritize the things that can be done and how we have to negotiate with like more conservative forces to be able to make changes that actually impact people's lives. But I would say that for our party, themes that are priority are kind of the ones that are reflected in the demands of the social uprising. I would say a change, a universalization and democratization of the educational system, including universities, a universalization of the health system that today is very divided between public and private health with a very bad public health. So we want to create like a universal health system that actually everybody can access good health, a reform of the pension system that I was saying before, that we have like very bad pensions for the old people that retire. For doing all of this, of course, a tax reform is necessary, tax reform that will basically distribute money a little bit better. And what has to do with the environment, like a green kind of green transition of the economic model, I would say.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Antonio, for joining us.
Great. Thank you, Luisa, for inviting me, and greetings to all of your audience. It was great being here. Venenos tus monólogos, tus discursos incoloros. No ves que no estamos solos. Millones de polo a polo al son de un solo coro. Marcharemos con el tono, con la convicción que basta de robo. Tu estado de control, tu trono podrido de oro. Tu política y tu riqueza y tu tesoro. No, la hora sonó, la hora sonó. No permitiremos más, más tu doctrina del shock. La hora sonó, la hora sonó. La hora sonó, la hora sonó. La hora sonó, la hora sonó. La hora sonó, la hora sonó.
That music is titled Shock by Anna Tijoux. That's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour for January 10th, 2022. Thanks to Mole's Bill Resnick and his guest, Bill Smaldone, Dan Hawken, Joe Clement, and Luisa Martinez for their pieces today, as well as Denise Morris for her editing expertise. Join us again next Monday for news, interviews, and reviews from the ground up, that is, the Mole's perspective. This is Sharon Grant. Thanks for listening.